Substation Podcast. My name is Tom Edwards, and I'm joined by
Emma Burns.
And tonight we're going to start off talking about security of the supply, which is something we started talking. I think we briefly discussed it in October last year when things were starting to look dicey, and they have the diciness has materialized. So now feels like an opportune moment to discuss security of supply and the concepts thereof.
Yeah, and we thought this would be kind of a cool topic, general topic to have. So like we covered data and we looked at that and from a different number of different angles, security of supply felt like a nice next topic to cover, and we'll have a number of different episodes on this as well.
It's one of those nice kind of planning things as well. It's a bit less operational than the other one. And it's now a bit more strategic as well.
Yeah, I'm into that. So this episode, I guess in my head, I'm calling it Security of Supply 101. So I thought we would introduce some of the key concepts to security of supply, what that means for electricity and gas. And then in a later episode, we can cover kind of market mechanisms that are used to ensure security of supply and potentially other topics that might spring to mind through the course of this episode and the next and different angles. Because I think there are, it's not a straightforward topic and there's a number of different ways you can come at it. But for now, we'll start with the key concepts. So as you mentioned, Tom, it's been a topic where there's been a lot of discussion around it recently. So we've obviously had the gas crisis in the last couple of months. We are having.
So this is a really interesting set of circumstances that have all happened together. So I would say probably the most important amongst them is that China has become the world's largest LNG importer, and this is partly due to their having their own electricity and fuel crisis. So they've needed to bring in a lot more gas, they've had to burn less coal, partly because of labour shortages due to like shutdowns and lockdowns affecting coal mining, and partly due to kind of air emissions quality stuff. So they've had to bring a lot more gas to burn gas to run their economy that's the workshop of the world. So if there's a huge new consumer of gas in the market that's, you know, bigger than the traditional big one, then that's going to upset all sorts of things. You've also got issues around how low European gas storage was, because the essentially just drawing down on reserves over that were put in 2020 meant that the stocks were very low. Prices were also very low in 2020, so there wasn't much incentive to put stuff in. There was a very mild winter as well, which meant that there was lots of drawdown and then it wasn't going in. You've also got geopolitical wranglings. It's probably a good way to put it. So Russia playing perhaps games around the accreditation of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in its attempt to circumvent gas transit around Ukraine. You've also got a lack of drilling going on for shale in North America. So a lot of the shale gas producers have been basically increasing their capital discipline, and they haven't been drilling wells. They've just been relying on wells that were already spudded. Yeah, that's the technical term, I believe. Not a gas expert, TM, but I believe that's the term. So there's all of these influences coupled with the fact that Britain and Europe operate on a kind of spot gas model. So the idea is that there's a spot market. So if you want to buy gas, there aren't as many as there used to be big long-term contracts that you sign with producers far away who'll either ship it to you by pipe or boat. It's more around that there are liquid hubs.
Which is an interesting point, because I suppose this whole principle of having spot markets and having kind of real-time pricing and close to real-time procurement has been a real principle of, I suppose, market design and European market design legislation, as opposed to sort of having those long-term contracts. Yeah. And now we're kind of seeing the downside of that.
There is a downside, which is if someone doesn't buy the gas, then you're stuck on the spot price, which has to rise to bring the gas from where it has been contracted to go. So we've seen things like cargoes that are destined for other markets have actually paid the termination fee to turn the boat around and bring them over to Europe. And that has happened. And the reason the prices have gone so high is to draw the gas here, which has basically meant that people have had to terminate contracts for effectively LNG tankers. The shipping rates are expensive. you've got to do a lot of kind of booking in to get these things going from where they got to go. So there's quite a hefty price to turn them around. And therefore, that's why the gas price has gone so high, is to bring this gas over here and to basically reallocate the market around. And that's the strength, and you might say weakness, of the spot market, in that it can do it and the price can rise to it. But on the other hand, you then expose everyone to that price. That leads on to ongoing, you know, this cascade effects there.
But I guess, yeah, it effectively means that we've got almost like an unhedged gas market, right? Because we're relying on those spot prices.
Yeah. Historically, when National Grid has written their winter outlooks, so this is a document National Grid publishes at the start of every winter to say, you know, what have we got coming in? What's on the bars? You know, what power stations are available? What's the security of supply situation likely to be for the upcoming winter? Historically, they've always said, or not always said, but historically, last couple of years, they've been saying, don't worry, Britain has enough capacity to bring all the gas we ever want. We just have to pay the money to bring it here. And this is the first time we've really seen what that physically means, which is, in a tight gas market, you pay £4 a therm.
And I guess all of these factors, they primarily have affected the gas market and gas security of supply. And that's had, as you mentioned, kind of knock-on impact on prices. And then separately to that, in running in parallel, we've also had National Grid's electricity outlook. So the winter outlook that it published in October, where I guess, suppose even before the gas market in the state that it is in, it was saying that the risk for power cuts has increased this winter, just looking at the available capacity margins, or how much electricity we have versus how much we might need. Their margins were the lowest they've been for 5 years, and they could be around 6.6% of demand. So that's kind of the cushion or kind of buffer that we have, but could fall as low as 4.2%.
Yeah. This is primarily driven by things like, you know, half of the cable to France catching fire, the Norwegians not allowing the full capacity of their cable to come online. We've closed Hunterston nuclear power station now. I think it's just closed yesterday or the day before. The Germans have closed their nuclear power stations. Some might say rather foolishly. You've got problems in France with the reliability of their aging nuclear fleet. So there's all this sorts of stuff going on. It's not just a gas price issue. There's also capacity, like provision issues. So to the extent that I think in that, like 4.2% is even quite rosy. In some weeks they were saying that, you know, if the interconnectors weren't flowing inwards, then GB would not be able to maintain security of supply. So there might be some periods, you know, very low wind speeds across the whole of Europe that, you know, if we aren't getting power from the continent, we can't maintain security of supply.
And that concept of what maintaining security of supply means is, I suppose, can be a bit of a nuanced one.
Mm.
I guess the other relevant bit of context is that we have seen a few recent examples of disconnections or a loss of security of supply across the world. So, you know, in Texas last year, in February, we saw a major power crisis following winter storms, where I believe gas stations were impacted, and there was sort of more than 4.5 million homes left without power, and, you know, a huge number of lives lost as a result of sort of rolling blackouts, so rolling disconnections of the system. Similarly, in South Africa, since 2007, there's been a number of problems with overall lack of adequate generating capacity. So there's been same kind of intervention where you've had to disconnect customers at different points during the day. And here in the UK and in GB, back in 2019 in August, we, following again a sort of stormy weather and problems with the transmission network, we saw the sudden loss of quite a lot of generation, which triggered an automatic but relatively short-lived disconnection of over 1 million customers. So I suppose, yeah, the threat to security of supply is real.
I think you described like three kind of horizons there as well. You've got the kind of short term. I think the GB one was kind of more of a, you might say, a blip. It happened very quickly and didn't last as long as the others. The Texas one was relatively long lived, but was the cause of a kind of was it a freak event? It, you know, lot, there was over 10, it was tens of gigawatts of power was lost because of the very cold weather.
Yeah. It was extreme weather.
Yeah.
Circumstances.
But they had the capacity. It wasn't an issue with them not having enough capacity. It was that the capacity broke. And then South Africa is more of a kind of long running issue with investment in capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, yeah, we can, well, let's dive into those case studies in a bit more detail, because I saw with the ENI blackout, there's never, it doesn't seem to be that there's ever one particular cause. It's usually kind of a conflation of different things and knock-on effects. Well, for now, let's focus on some key concepts. So what is security of supply, Tom?
So I had real difficulty finding a dictionary definition of this. I looked in my textbooks. I looked online in the government publishes a security of supply report. Ofgem has a security of supply report. There's the Winter Outlook. But there's they weren't very good at supplying an actual definition. So one thing I did find was in a UKPN report, so that's UK Power Networks. They said security of supply refers to the in this case, electricity industry providing appropriate electricity system capabilities, such as generation and transmission capacity, to maintain normal supply to consumers.
That's quite
a lot.
Keeping
to
the lights on.
Yeah, yeah.
Simpler way of putting it, and I suppose it's a different in electricity and gas. You know, this concept of security of supply is different because of the need to balance second by second. You know, if you have either too much energy or too little energy, that can lead to blackouts, that can lead to loss of supply, and nobody gets any energy. So it's not like another product such as bananas, whereby if you don't have enough bananas, nobody gets any bananas.
The bananas are still in the warehouse, they're just not here yet.
Yeah, exactly. That.
Or you can have one banana, but you can't have five.
Exactly.
Whereas in electricity, you either get exactly what you want or nothing.
Exactly. I suppose it's, you need that second by second matching, but it also needs to be the right kind of energy. So system stability as well. You know, this, it's not just megawatts. It's the right kind of megawatts, which again, we'll dive into that. That's important.
So you mentioned before margins, and there's lots of people always talk about margins. Why are margins so important?
Yeah, as you mentioned, sort of it's second by second balancing, which is important. So you need to match, you need to have exactly the right amount being produced as being consumed. However, because of that need, and because of the risk to that not happening, you need to ensure that you've got kind of adequate capacity over and above. So a buffer, or a margin, as we say, to protect against unforeseen outages of generation or an unforeseen increase in demand. So it's that kind of the margin, sometimes called the derated margin, to account for the risk around that, or the capacity margin, which is super important in electricity.
There is a margin in gas, but you can also have the line pack can be the buffer as well.
Yes.
So you can use that, but you've got to maintain the pressure in gas. But because you can squeeze gas.
Exactly.
It's a bit
easier
to manage.
Gas isn't second by second balancing. It's kind of day-to-day balancing. It's a bit less, but in electricity in particular, this idea of having, you know, enough margins, so enough basically generation in reserve, so not necessarily generating but ready to go if we need it, which is central to the functioning of a
it's a buffer
market.
Like you said, it's that extra bit in the back, in your back pocket, just in case something goes wrong.
It's a cushion in your back pocket.
Yeah.
And historically we have had, especially in the UK, you know, more than adequate margins to meet demand, but over the last 10, 15 years or so, those margins have been decreasing. So we've seen kind of fossil fuel generators being caught by various environmental regulations, or even just aging, coming to the end of their useful lives, so therefore they're closing. And we've also seen assets being displaced effectively by renewable assets and becoming less profitable. So we've seen gas-fired stations closing or mothballing. Yeah, we used to have a bigger buffer in the UK, but now that's been kind of eroded over time. And as a result, this has sort of increased these risks to security of supply and sort of led to increasing interventions in the market, which we'll come on to, I think, a bit more in the next episode, to sort of ensure that there are adequate margins going forward. And because that was one of the key metrics that we mentioned earlier in National Grid's Winter Outlook report, where they report on, you know, what percentage available margin do we have compared to demand going into a winter when demand is highest.
So then the gas and electricity systems are very integrated, correlated. Are there any similar kind of problems that you have to face in the gas system as well as the power system?
It's obviously very important because it has a key role in producing electricity and obviously in heating homes. And so it is one of those essential services that we need to sort of support the functioning of society. Ensuring gas security of supply is just as important as ensuring electricity of supply. There are some interesting differences though. So gas production is an international gas market. There are more ways to move gas from one place to another than there are electricity. So you have, I suppose, not only pipelines, but also liquefied natural gas tankers, which, you know, effectively ships where you can move gas around. So the kind of the challenges there are different. We talk a lot about diversity of gas supply. And that's what we're talking about there is sort of where is the gas actually coming from, sort of which countries, which jurisdictions, rather than sort of what kind of technology is being used to produce it.
Because it's all, yeah, again, it's all methane, but who we buy it from is important and how reliable they are. I guess it's similar in that it's very weather driven as well. So gas demand is extremely seasonal because of its use mainly in heating. So we need a lot of it in the winter and not as much of it in the summer because the primary means of heating homes in Great Britain is gas. So it's very important for that. And obviously that means it's got a political implication because many more people would be in dire jeopardy if they weren't able to heat their homes, given our, position in the globe and it being cold in the winter. So there's that very important important part. We also have our own kind of gas fields as well, but they are declining. So that adds, you know, it's a very clear trajectory downwards as those gas fields reserves are used.
And it's funny because back in the day we used to say that we could store gas and we couldn't really store electricity. But, well, certainly in GB, that's almost kind of flipped around now where we see increasing amounts of electricity storage, but our capacity to store gas locally has reduced in the last few years as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, so GB is unusual in that it only had one big long-term gas storage site, which was called Rough, which was an old oil field off the in the North Sea. One of the great things about gases is that you can store them for a long time. So unlike electricity, which you can realistically only store for a couple of days, at most, gas you can store for a whole season. So one of the things that they've got on the continent is seasonal gas storage, is you take in the gas in the summer when it's cheap, and then you stick it in a hole underground and take it out in the winter when you need it. We had one facility in Rough. The wellhead was degraded so that in 2016 and 2017, the decision was taken not to basically spend the money that would be needed to keep it in operation. And now GB only has medium kind of weeks duration gas storage for salt from salt caverns and kind of tanker storage. So that's one of the things about gas is, yeah, you can do the seasonal thing with it. And we decided, controversially now looking back at it, at the time it was thought, well, actually we just use the European gas storage, they've got loads and we're well interconnected to Europe, so we'll just let them store it and we'll pay to bring it in over here. The problem being is that if the Europeans don't have the capacity or didn't stick the gas underground in the mm-hmm. summer, then mm-hmm. we can't bring it over either.
Who made that decision? Is it was a kind of privately owned company, privately owned venture, but they were looking for additional support from government.
Centrica owned Rough, and they said it's going to cost us billions to fix Rough. Mm. We do not believe this asset will make us enough money to do that. I guess maybe with hindsight, perhaps they were wrong, but at the time they were saying, looking at, you know, the expected spreads that there will be between summer and winter gas, we can't see enough profit to invest this money. Government, would you like to spend money on a obviously strategic asset? And the government said no. I mean, at the time the decision was, we'll use the European gas storage. They'll always fill themselves up over summer and we'll just bring it in over the pipeline through Bacton. But that didn't happen.
What are the implications of not having adequate margins or the right kind of supply? So we've already mentioned blackouts, and by that we mean electricity disconnections, and they can be either a partial system blackout, like what we saw in GB in August 2019, or, so as God forbid, a system-wide total system blackout, which thank God we've never seen in GB. There's also this concept of brownouts, which in GB in the UK we define brownouts as voltage reduction, so reducing the voltage on the network, which might mean effectively less power flowing to houses. You might have lights flickering.
Yeah.
I think in other jurisdictions they use brownouts to mean a partial system blackout, just to confuse things slightly. But yeah, certainly here we take that to mean a reduction in voltage, which again isn't, you know, clearly not as impactful as the complete disconnection of energy supply, but can have implications for equipment and that kind of thing.
It's more of a concern for industrial consumers because they'll find things like motors and three-phase equipment doesn't work as well, and that can be damaging to that equipment. Whereas in the home, you would probably most likely experience it as your lights flickering.
Yeah. Exactly. And then it says within blackouts, there's kind of two main kinds of blackouts. So there's kind of these rolling blackouts that we mentioned before, where you kind of have effectively foresight that there is a capacity adequacy problem. So you have the system operator or the distribution network operators disconnecting demand on a rolling basis. So different portions of demand at different times.
So east of England, you don't have power between 2 and 3 o'clock. And then northern England, you don't have power between 3 and 4 o'clock. And then Wales, you don't have power between 4 and 5. And then and just going around. And it might not even be that. It might just be, okay, everyone with this postcode and
exactly
randomly across the country doesn't get it.
You have a number on your energy bill, don't you?
If you look in the fuel security code and there is a plan for rota disconnections.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's the kind of the rota or rolling disconnections. The other kind of blackout is what we mentioned before that happened in GB. So this, well, what we call here a low frequency demand disconnection, so LFDD, which is more of it's effectively like an automatic trigger to disconnect demand. So it's a trip. Yeah. It's when you don't have foresight, you don't have the ability to kind of manage the demand control. It's more of a trip, an automatic trigger that just cuts off a certain proportion of demand, and it's done in, well, blocks. So it's 5% of demand, or estimated 5% demand first, and then another 5%. And there's plans for doing that at different stages.
So the rolling blackouts is, we know we don't have enough capacity, so we're going to ration your electricity or energy supply so that we can keep the whole system running and everyone can get some.
Yeah.
And a demand control or a low frequency demand disconnection is, something's gone wrong. We urgently need to trip off a bit of supply somewhere that has been determined by some engineers working in a network company in order to save the whole system so that you can have electricity tomorrow.
Exactly. It's a super, super important part of the system. And it's what triggers the disconnection is a fall in frequency. So the purpose there is, you know, something happens, say a generator trips or a number of generators trip, frequency falls, and to sort of arrest that fall and to, you know, to stop the frequency falling further and leading us to a total system blackout, we have these triggers in there to just sort of effectively sacrifice just a portion of demand. And, you know, it's worth saying, well, when we have used it in GB, it's been quite a short duration outage. So I think when we, in August 2019, most customers were reconnected within an hour. So it's in some ways a less severe kind of situation that you would be in compared to kind of rolling disconnections, where, you know, it tends to be a more fundamental issue with the system. And I guess we can't talk about blackouts and we can't talk about system-wide blackouts without talking about black start. a system-wide blackout is, we're saying, is a real doomsday kind of scenario. You know,
you need electricity to start power stations. So the idea of black start is a, I guess, an overly ominous name for what you might call system restoration. It's starting from a blackout, basically.
Yeah.
What do you? How do you restore the system once you've lost it? If you have to turn the electricity transmission distribution systems back on, how mm-hmm. do you do it?
Mm-hmm.
And black start is the process for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is super important because if you imagine this is a national crisis that's mm-hmm. just occurred, it's very likely that a lot of the communication systems aren't working. It's very likely that maybe hospitals are strained, that government capacity is strained. So this is a hugely important process. It's about how do you turn the lights back on? Power stations need electricity to operate. Mm-hmm. They've got pumps, computers, all sorts of stuff. They can't supply themselves because they generally tend to use the AC power network.
Mm-hmm.
So what the system operator does is it pays to have strategic power stations dotted around the country that are capable of starting themselves up with dedicated comms lines so that in the case of a blackout, they can talk to the control center.
Mm-hmm.
These small power stations will then be able to restart the large power stations. And then the control center will be able to coordinate the reconnection of blocks of load. So mm-hmm. essentially, they'll create a skeleton network out of all of these power stations and then reconnect bits of the network one by one to basically create the load and block. I think it's a 50 megawatt block.
Mm.
They'll do that. And I think the expectation is that this could take days and it might have to happen a number of times.
Yeah.
Because what you're effectively doing is when they flip the breakers, they're supposed to be able to do it in 50 megawatt blocks, but you might find that, you know, you might find the draw suddenly increasing. You know, when people have power, they might then go, oh, I want to charge everything and do everything. The power might be greater. So actually you might overload the capability of the power stations to provide that. So the expectation is you've got to have a lot of fuel on site. The thing has to be able to start and stop multiple times because this has never been done before.
Yeah.
Might need to happen. But it might not necessarily be the smoothest of
Well, that's the thing.
Processes.
It's never been done before, and you're trying to do it against the context of complete chaos in terms of society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a plan. So somebody's thought about it. We spend a lot of money in keeping these power stations around.
Yeah.
So.
And I suppose worth noting that sort of Black Start, this service, because it's so important, it's probably also an area where we've seen less change compared to other balancing services. But that change is happening. So there are initiatives trying to look at, you know, diversifying the kinds of assets that we could include in those restoration or black start services. But I think ultimately, I suppose this is kind of one of the places where decarbonization just gets trumped by, you know, the need to get the lights back on, I suppose.
As long as we never burn the oil, I think it's fine for it to sit there and
yeah.
And not get used.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy for the backup to be oil if we barely ever run it.
Yeah.
I think that's probably fine. We can make up by reducing emissions in other areas to make sure that this thing works because this is more important.
Yeah, exactly.
Than, say, driving a car. You know, some people could give up driving to keep the black start generators running.
Yeah.
A lot of people, but...
Yeah. And also just have, yeah, focus on having a secure system so we never use it. This is a service we hope we never use, basically, even though we'll pay for it.
Yeah. So besides margin, what other components do we want from our security of supply? What do we want our system to have in order for it to be secure?
Yeah, I guess focusing just on margin is maybe a little bit simplistic, because I guess that just looks at how many megawatts do we have and how many megawatts do we need. In practice, you know, we know electricity is a bit more complicated than that, and as is gas. So, you know, we talk about kind of reliability more generally. So that's ensuring that the networks, so the transmission and the distribution networks, can support generation meeting demand.
So that's in the case of like a storm blowing down a transmission line or a flood taking out a compressor station, there needs to be enough backup network capacity so that the power or the gas can flow another route.
Exactly, yeah. And also that system stability is there as well.
So a big shock can't, you know, take the system out. So Exactly. Lightning, for example, lightning hits a wire and causes a voltage oscillation and a power station trips offline.
And we've got things like adequate levels of inertia, which I think we've probably covered in previous podcasts, and voltage. You know, electricity isn't just a simple product. There's different angles to it that need to be kept in balance as well as just the megawatts.
So this is all about risk management, effectively. What are the risks that we're kind of protecting about? So a really important concept is diversity. And one of the, maybe it's an old argument, I'm not entirely sure I hear it so much nowadays, but I remember 10 years ago that a lot of the government stuff was that as long as we have a diverse set of supplies, then we should be secure. Because if there's too much coming from one source, then we're overexposed to that source. So I guess you might look at the gas crisis and say, well, look, if we had more nukes, then we wouldn't be as exposed. If we had more renewables, we wouldn't be as exposed. And you might say the same thing during a wind drought. You know, if we have too much wind and we're too reliant on the wind, then we'll be overexposed to that. So diversity is a really important concept, I think, in security of supply.
So I suppose, yeah, all of this means that customers aren't just buying electricity. It's more about a service that can be defined as the provision of energy with a certain level of reliability.
So when I flip the light switch, I expect the light to come on. So then what are the qualities of reliability? What do I want from, how do I value this? What's the, you know, how are we going to measure that service? You can have different qualities. So for example, if I lose my power for seconds, I'm probably not going to be too upset. But if I lose it for days, I probably will be. And if it's lost for years, then that's a very significant problem. So there's different time spans over which we might measure security of supply. So years is important because all of this infrastructure takes years to build and to operate. And we need to plan ahead of time for everything that either wants or provides energy. Days is important because, you know, people might die in that time period. And seconds is important because of the, as we mentioned before, that's how long it can take for a problem to happen on the system. I mentioned there that there's planning, so the amount of warning or foresight we might have over an issue. So we might only know within hours that a power station has tripped and is broken, and there's not very much we can do about it. But we have a reasonable amount of warning about when a power station is going to close, because it's aging, people have to make financial decisions, they have to sign contracts to decommission it and all that sort of stuff. So there's different timescales about how we might plan for that and be warned about a problem that's occurring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Different stuff has different costs as well.
Well, I suppose related to this, no supply is ever 100% reliable. So people will be, I'm sure everybody's suffered some kind of outage, probably usually a local outage. So a problem with the distribution network, you know, a tree falls on a wire and it takes some time for that electricity to be established. I suppose in the broader sense, in the kind of national sense, there's this concept of an acceptable level of outages. So related to this is kind of this idea of gold plating, which basically means energy systems where there's been overinvesting in networks and in the system. So kind of gold plating, and that leads to a higher cost, which is sort of higher than customers would be willing to pay for. So related to this is another key concept, which is value of lost load, which is a sort of a notional metric, which is used to reflect the price of security of supply. So how much ultimately are customers willing to pay to keep the light, their own lights on. It's a theoretical concept. And in an ideal world, every customer would be able to self-select the point at which they want to turn off, and that they would be willing to turn their lights off or reduce their consumption. But in practice, we're not in that world yet. So instead, we have this centrally defined value that is the right price that we are as a country or as a nation willing to pay for our electricity. And that's reflected by this VOL, V-O-L-L metric.
I mean, one of the things I really enjoy talking about is VOL, because it's a really quite academic but very markety bit, because you mentioned there's how much people are willing to be paid or pay to keep the lights on, but it could also be how much are you willing to be paid to not have the lights on. And people give different answers depending on whether or not you're paying them or they are paying for it.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right? Is how do you actually define VOL in the first place? Because you have to do surveys. You have to ask people, And it's, as you say, one of those two questions, like how much would you be willing to pay to avoid an outage, or how much would you want as compensation if you've been subject to an outage? And because of how humans are, those answers are often.
And that's fascinating in and of itself. I think the other, bringing it back to our case study or context at the beginning with the gas crisis, the idea of spot markets is that you would get people responding to the price. If it goes very, very high, people should reduce their consumption. But we didn't see that. We haven't seen gas consumption responding. Like, prices have gone to extremely high levels, levels that people didn't think were possible, that we thought we would see demand response. To the point at which we did see demand response, we actually saw big fertilizer producers reducing their output. But then that meant that there were further effects on the supply chain, because fertilizer production affects food production, but also byproducts of things like CO2, which goes into, you know, drinks manufacture, food preservation. And supply chains were grinding to a halt because one party had taken a decision to cut back because of a gas price signal. And actually, we couldn't let them do that. There had to be, government had to step in and say, actually, you need to keep producing no matter what the price is. Our economy is so fragile and brittle and so interconnected that you actually can't respond as you would do to a price signal. And I think that's really fascinating, is that maybe vol isn't as simple as you think it is. It's very interconnected, because industrial consumers are part of a web that, depending on how, not only how adequate is our energy system, but our whole economy has to have a level of resilience in it, because, and I'll probably talk about this in the final session when we talk about how do we transition to the, to, you know, a net zero, what does security supply mean in a net zero world, but our energy system can't be the end of the security of supply chain. We actually have to think about the whole economy, because if for example we had, you know, more warehousing, if we didn't have a just-in-time supply chain, perhaps our economy would be a bit more resilient and we could cope with prices spiking in energy.
There's different kind of concepts within that, though, isn't there? So there's kind of, what is an individual customer's willingness to pay? So its own individual vol. Then kind of above that, we have what's the administratively determined average customer vol, which again is kind of an aggregate of all the different kinds of customers and, you know, averages, load of stuff. But then a bit up above that again is, well, what's the cost to the system? You know, what's the ultimate price if there was a system blackout, you know, total system-wide blackout? What would that actual price be, which is a bigger value probably than all the vols added together?
Yeah, let's just assume it's basically infinite.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, that the vol is an interesting concept, because it's often used as a fixed single value. And as we know, every customer is different. It depends on the time of day. It depends on whether you're having your dinner or watching the World Cup sports game. You know, as we were talking earlier, I wouldn't mind right now, if I'm about to go out for a walk, probably for an hour, I'd have an outage. That would be fine. But other customers are in very different positions to that, and obviously rely on their security supply for their livelihoods and then their lives ultimately.
I think it would be a fascinating experiment to ask someone, how much would you be willing to be paid to sit in the dark for an hour with no communication?
Everything I have is fully charged.
Yeah, but so I've got... the mobile phone towers won't work. Your data center's not working. The exchange at the end of the street isn't working. So none of your internet's not working. Your mobile phone won't work. Yeah, the TV station's not broadcasting.
I've got my candles.
Okay.
I've got some downloaded music.
Yeah. I mean, how many...
I have my imagination.
Yeah. But so you say, okay, 50 quid, and then actually make you sit there in the dark with no phone, no communication for an hour, and see if you still agree, is 50 quid a suitable compensation at the end? Terrible. So I would try to work out how much I could fleece the experimenter for. But I think if you ask my daughter, she would definitely, well, actually, yeah, no, because that would, the cascade fallout of that would fall back on me. So I'd probably want more. Yeah.
And I guess, well, the other interesting thing about willingness to pay as a concept is people with more money can pay more. So there's kind of difficult questions around, you know, vulnerable and fuel poor customers there as well.
So would you say then that reliability and security of supply is a public good?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the kind of interesting thing when it comes to electricity as a product and electricity markets. You know, it's a public good, which means it's, you know, it's a shared commodity. It's like a, it's like street lights, you know, it's not a private good. There's no exclusive use for that good. And that creates interesting questions for policymakers and market designers, how to ensure that you're preventing kind of free riding, that you are providing the right amount. And as you mentioned, that we are providing the appropriate level of margins.
And free riding is where you might have paid for a minimum level of system security, but that benefits everybody else, but nobody else has paid for it. So then everyone, if everyone were rational actors, then nobody would pay for it, because we all know that you'd pay for it and you'd be left with picking up the bill.
Exactly. And because reliability and security supply is this public good, there is often kind of government or central interventions to ensure that we have the quote unquote right amount, which is where this concept of vol, so the, you know, the price of disconnections or the price people are willing to pay for security supply, kind of can often be reflected. And that's used to determine what is quote unquote the right or the correct level of disconnections. So sometimes that's called the loss of load expectation, which is effectively a defined amount of hours that we as a nation, as a system, are willing to accept that energy will not be supplied through the normal operation of the market. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we will have, you know, X hours of a system-wide blackout, as we've mentioned, that will be very, very unlikely and hopefully will never happen. But there are a number of kind of emergency interventions that can be used to prevent the lights from going out after the normal market has done its job. So, you know, we could curtail interconnectors. So if the wires connecting us to other countries are exporting in an emergency, we could effectively, I was about to say cut them, but we could stop the energy from flowing to other countries.
Or we could ask them to produce more.
Or ask them to produce more, exactly. We can, there's something called Max Gen, so maximum generation, which is a service that generators can provide. It's effectively asking generators to turn up to 11. So, you know, there'll be certain specifications the generators are meant to typically operate within, but in sort of very special circumstances they may be able to go above that. So that kind of max gen service is something that could be used if we are sort of in a real capacity crunch or tight system margin scenario. And then after that, there's these sort of demand control actions that we mentioned earlier, where you're saying, okay, let's take interventions to reduce demand, either through brownouts, you know, voltage control, or blackouts, you know, actually disconnecting customers.
So I think wrapping that up then, security of supply is the ability to provide the appropriate capability to maintain supply to customers across a range of timescales that are ranging from like seconds to years. And the tools that we have are a lot of the market mechanisms, but there's also some emergency mechanisms. And then we've got some kind of restart mechanisms afterwards. And a lot of that
exactly
filters back through into some decisions that are taken at a policy level around the acceptable level of security of supply and the value that customers place on that.
Exactly. Yeah. There's your definition. Perfect. Easy. And I guess what we haven't covered here, but we've sort of skirted around, are those market mechanisms, because there's different ways to design the market and design the mechanisms for ensuring that security of supply, which we will cover in the next episode.
Looking forward. Going to talk about the capacity market a little bit.
Yeah, me too. Bit of market design. Can't beat it.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed. We, as you can obviously tell, we enjoyed talking about it. And we're going to come back to you next time. We're going to talk about the market mechanisms for providing security of supply. And we might then also look at some case studies at different you know, security of supply events and energy crises around the world. And we're going to finish off by looking at what does security supply mean in a net zero future transition world, and how might we deliver it, what the challenges might be. Thanks for listening. I've been Tom. And
I've been Emma.
And you've been listening to the Substation Podcast.